friends, hello. Thank you so much for joining me. This is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse at naturalnurse.com, hoping that you are staying healthy and hoping that you and your loved ones know the natural way to stay that way. And it's so interesting, in the many years that I have been working in natural medicine, which actually started in 1964, to this day, there is always something new to learn. You just don't know everything. But yesterday I had a wonderful class where we went outside and I taught people what plants they can eat that grow wild right in their yard. And that's something that I suggest everyone learn how to do. First of all, it can be a very fun hobby. So you can just learn about it for sort of an interest. And then again, it could save your life. Because just think about, if the electricity went out, what would you do if there was no food in the refrigerator and you had used up any kind of stored food? And hopefully you do have a lot of stored food, because that's also a very good idea. And not frozen, because if the electricity goes out, then frozen food will be useless. One of the things I have quite a bit of is dehydrated food and also freeze-dried food, because they can be kept for very long periods of time, sometimes up to 30 years, and still be edible. But then also, it's a good idea to know what wild plants grow outside in your yard, because they sort of, a lot of people go, oh my goodness, before I took your class, I thought these were all weeds. And you know, when you're an herbalist, the definition of a weed is just means any plant that's growing where you don't want it to. There's no inner meaning to the word weed. Weed is just a plant that you don't want to grow somewhere. But sometimes when you find out that that plant is more nutritious than what you're trying to grow in your garden, and of course it's free because it was put there by God or nature, no one planted it, at least you didn't have to go through the process of planting it, and it might be much higher in omega-3 fatty acids, it might be very high in some kind of naturally occurring component that can get rid of whatever kind of condition you might have. It might be antimicrobial, for instance. It might get rid of parasites. It might leach out heavy metals and radiation. We found a plant yesterday that does that. That's called yellow dock root. So, of course, you have to start learning, because some plants have poisonous lookalikes. There are some plants that are completely safe. There are some plants that are highly edible and that can be added to your salad or your soup or any other kind of cooked preparation that you have. There are plants that can be eaten raw. There are plants that you can crush and rub on your skin to stop bugs from biting you. So they have an entire myriad of uses. And as Dr. Zamperone and I discuss in our book, The Natural Medicine Chest, there is a long political history. You know, wasn't so long ago, only a few decades ago, when all physicians were highly trained in the use of natural medicine. And they had in their textbooks and in the Merck manual, perhaps you've heard of the Merck manual, it's a book that doctors use to look conditions up and to look therapies up, it was loaded with what herb to use for various conditions. And so that was highly understood, and this was in conventional medicine. And then what happened is, early in the century, there's an entire grouping of conditions that sort of came together. And that was really the start of the AMA, which is the American Medical Association, and the pharmaceutical giants. For instance, in 1924, the AMA, who was already getting to be pretty powerful, under the leadership of a gentleman known as Morris Fishbein, who was the editor of JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, and he was really focusing on getting rid of anybody, such as chiropractors or naturopathic physicians or osteopathic physicians or anyone who he determined was a medical irregular. So what he did was went around and actually got them imprisoned for practicing their healing arts without a license. And also, he joined together with various other entities. And one of the things they did was go around to different medical schools and say, if you want to get funded, that would be fine. You can be funded as long as you teach only drugs, which are pharmaceutical drugs. That was, of course, backed by the AMA, and surgery. So often now, doctors are wondering, how is it that their knowledge is so limited? At that same time in history, there was a revamping of all the medical textbook companies, the same entities that were giving grants to medical schools who would agree to teach only pharmaceutical drugs and surgery, also started their own medical textbook companies. So the medical schools were more or less forced to purchase only those particular textbooks that limited the knowledge that was being taught to physicians to drugs and surgery. So you see, this did not just happen. So many people now are wondering, how is it that my doctors do not know anything about natural remedies? And what's so funny, not funny, haha, but you know, sarcastically funny at this point in time, is that it is becoming more and more absurd and maybe even obscene for doctors to not understand about natural medicine, because when we use the word evidence-based means that there are specific studies showing the action of something. Well, that is happening more and more in all kinds of mainstream medical journals right now in terms of the efficacy of natural remedies, along with a much, much better what's called adverse event profile. Now, the adverse event profile is what we could look at in terms of the negative, what we call side effects of various therapies. So if we look at the negative side effects of pharmaceutical drugs. Let's talk about one that's been in the news lately. One that's been in the news lately would be statin drugs and also the drugs that are claimed to maintain bone hardness. We're not going to mention names, but you can look that up, right? On the internet, you can see all the cases right now that are being litigated for the very strong adverse event profiles that are happening with those pharmaceutical agents, in particular in terms of the supposedly bone-strengthening drugs. What they find is that women are getting more hip fractures as well as much more severe hip fractures once they have been using those drugs, especially over time. More than 5 years, than if they never used those drugs. So when we look at those kinds of figures in terms of what the evidence is showing, we're realizing more and more that pharmaceutical drug therapies, although they can be life-saving when used appropriately, for instance, in when somebody's having an anaphylactic shock, or they have asthma and they're no longer breathing, those are situations where pharmaceutical agents definitely can save your life, while natural medical interventions really may not be strong enough to make a difference in an emergency situation. But for ongoing health maintenance and for degenerative illnesses, which cause wear and tear on the body over time, then most pharmaceutical drugs are not only useless, but they make the condition worse. And they're able to mask some of the symptoms, but they are not able or even made to address the cause. And addressing the cause is the focus of natural medicine. So that's why we love to bring you The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and that's why we've written so many books, all of which you can see at naturalnurse.com if you look under books. And we also give educational courses if you go to naturalnurse.com and look under education, where you can learn to use many of these techniques for yourself and your family. Learn how to decide what plant you can use that grows right outside your door, when to pick it, when to harvest it, how to prepare it. And of course, there are wonderful remedies that are available in the health food store where these things are already done for you, but it's still good to know which herb would you use when. For instance, would you use echinacea at the beginning of a cold or flu, or would you use it after the symptoms have already started? Would you use milk thistle before you had a liver transplant, or would you use it after? So, you know, all these kinds of things are very important questions. And you can find out because there has been so much research done. Now, coming up on October 6th, and we do have all kinds of events listed at naturalnurse.com under schedules, but on October 6th in Connecticut, we're having a seminar which is called Natural Medicine Evidence-Based Seminar, and 5 CEU credits will be granted if people want to take it. So this is a seminar that is going to be at a level appropriate for professionals, any kind of professional such as MD, nurses, PhDs, nutritionists, chiropractors. Anyone who would like to take it can and get 5 credits, which most professionals need for their educational growth requirements. But we decided to also open it to the public. Although the presentations may be a little deep in terms of mechanisms of action of certain plant medicines that occur at the a physiological level, at the cell membrane level. So some of it might be a little high-ended, but you know, I know many consumers who have been studying natural medicine for many years and are interested in the evidence behind their use. So if you feel that you want to come and learn about that, we've decided to open this seminar up for anyone who would like to take it, the public. And you can get credits for it as well. The credits course just a little bit more, so people can choose not to get the credits if they do not want to. And that's how we decided to structure this particular seminar. And so there's so much to learn, you know, looking at the energy around someone. That sounds a little hokey to some people, but it has been used in all traditional medicine for thousands of years. What do I mean by traditional medicine? Many of you who listen to this program regularly will hear me correct the guests, even if they're physicians, in the use of that term, traditional medicine. What I mean by traditional medicine is medicine that has been used with great safety and efficacy for a very long period of time, sometimes many thousands of years. If we look at something like Chinese medicine or Tibetan medicine or Western herbal medicine, this is traditional medicine. So we're going to take a little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And by the way, we will be taking your calls this afternoon. We're going to have a guest on. The guest is going to be Dr. Holly Lucille, and I'll be introducing her shortly. And we're going to go out of this segment by bringing you one of our natural medicine chess. So we'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the ancient Chinese science and art of acupuncture.
Acupuncture is a 5,000-year-old medical procedure involving insertion and manipulation of needles into specific points on the body. It is often applied to relieve pain during surgery and for many other conditions.
Acupuncture needles have been found in China that are over 4,000 years old. The first needles were made of stone. Later, bronze, gold, or silver was used, and today they are usually made from steel. Acupuncture was developed around the theory of special meridian points on the body connected to the internal organs, and that vital energy, or qi, flows along these meridians. According to this theory, diseases are caused by interrupted energy flow, and the stimulation of these points restores normal energy circulation. There is some scientific evidence of the existence of the meridians as a separate circulatory system. Studies were done in the 1970s by a Dr. Kim from Korea, where he injected radioactive dyes into the traditional acupuncture points. He observed migration of the dyes along the exact predicted path of the meridians.
Okay. How acupuncture works remains uncertain, but both Western and Eastern scientific studies on rabbits have shown that the analgesic effects are not simply a matter of suggestion. After the discovery in 1975 of endorphins, natural pain inhibitors in the body, some neurophysiologists suggested that the needles may trigger the release of these substances. American and Chinese studies have confirmed that placing acupuncture needles in the brains of dogs raises the level of endorphins in the spinal fluid.
Acupuncture is used today in most hospitals in China and by many private practitioners in virtually every country in the world, including the United States. The primary use is for analgesia, although ulcers, hypertension, asthma, and other conditions have been documented to respond favorably to this treatment. Chinese surgeons prefer acupuncture to the use of drug-induced analgesia because they claim it does not disturb normal body physiology and therefore does not make the patient vulnerable to shock. Brain surgery is especially amenable to this form of analgesia when it is necessary to keep the patient awake during the operation.
Although some modifications in the practice of acupuncture have been made, such as sometimes using a small electric current on the needle instead of the traditional twirling, acupuncture remains intact as an ancient therapeutic technique that has been used successfully for at least 5,000 years. Perhaps you'd like to add this piece of knowledge to your natural medicine test.
And we're back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z on PRN, Gary Knowles radio station, where you can hear the best, truest, and most complete information about the world around you. And one of the great things is you can always visit PRN.fm, go to archives, and you can listen to our show on The Natural Nurse or any of the excellent shows right here on Progressive Radio Network. Today, we will have as our guest Dr. Lucille Holly. Dr. Lucille is an NDRN and is nationally recognized and licensed naturopathic doctor, an educator, and a natural products consultant. She is the author of Creating and Maintaining Balance, A Woman's Guide to Safe Natural Hormone Health, and serves on the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians Board of Directors. She is an acclaimed expert in the field of naturopathic medicine, and she lectures nationally and is regularly quoted in both consumer and peer journals, and was listed in the 2007 edition of Time Magazine's Top 100 Most Influential People. So thank you so much for coming on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
It is such my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, what guided you in your earlier life to become involved in naturopathic medicine?
Well, it actually was the way that my health care was delivered to me as a young child. My parents were both pharmacists, and literally if something was going on inside of me, they were like, here, take this. It was a pill. Or you know, if something was going on the outside, and he was like, here, put this on it. And it was my dad's company's branded Neosporin. And I always was like, why? What's it going to do for me? What, you know, will it hurt me? How much is it going to cost? How long will I have to take it? I had all these questions in there. They're like, yeah, whatever. Just take it. And then when I went to nursing school, I kind of had that same feeling like, oh my gosh. I wanted to know deeper questions, like why? Better rationale behind doctor's orders, more comprehensive sort of thought processes. And I thought, I'm just doomed. You know, I feel like I was kind of being pointed as maybe the trouble child. And then I found the American Holistic Nursing Association. And it was there that I was sort of validated, and I understood that, hey, it doesn't matter what education you have. It's how you apply it that counts. And it was there that I started to be able to understand and utilize more comprehensive and more, you know, universal principles of medicine. And it just made my heart sing. It made so much sense to me, the ability to partner with somebody and think things through and not be all reductionistic in the approach, even though I think there's value in all systems of medicine. For me, it was just that reductionistic approach that I didn't feel fit everywhere that was bothersome to me. So becoming a naturopathic doctor was sort of my next natural step.
That's an excellent story, Dr. Lucille. You know, I am a member of the American Holistic Nurses Association, and in fact, I have an AHNBC, which you probably know what that is, and I am an item writer.
Yes.
So I know just what you meant when I stumbled upon the American Holistic Nurses Association. I have to tell you, I really started crying because it was an organization that brought together medicine, and I very much admire the entire nursing profession. I'm very proud of being a nurse, and healing. And I thought, like, never the two could meet.
Yep. Isn't it great? And when they do meet, it seems like it just makes everything so much more calm and so much more simple and such a better milieu to actually heal within.
Now, you have a great website. I always look at my guest's website, and just so you know, listeners, we will have this posted on our archive when we're done with today's show, but it's Dr., but that's drhollylucille.com. And it's so, you know, what I love about your site is you're bringing together a lot of very youthful feeling there, where it's sort of trendy and easy to read, but it has great information.
Well, I really appreciate that because if anybody, you know, anybody who has built a site or, you know, wants to communicate in the digital, you know, platform these days, who they are, it's not easy. You know, I would prefer to have a one-on-one conversation with every single person that I actually could. And so the medium of the web and stuff is pretty tricky. And I did work hard to try to at least engage people in the conversation and have them understand who I was, because, you know, I'm not for everybody. I really am not. And I wanted people to understand what my intention is, you know, why I'm in it, why I do what I do, because I really think that that's the most important thing when it comes to providing a service. It's not the who am I, what is naturopathic medicine. It's like, what's important to me? And important to me is I want everybody to end up being their own primary caregivers at the end of the day. You know, I did this little joke once, kind of like jaywalking, and went around and said, do you have a primary care provider? Do you have a primary care provider? And, you know, I had multiple answers, and people were, like, fussling through their purse and trying to find their insurance card or what have you, or they'd name their doctor off. And, you know, my message was, at the end of the day, and quite honestly, at the beginning of the day, aren't we the ones that are primarily in charge of providing care for ourselves? And that's my big thing, is that if we could sift through all of the information out there, sometimes misinformation, help people use their own brain so they can make better informed choices for them and their family. That's why I do it.
And you have so much really great specific information. And so let's go into some of the knowledge that you have about something that influences so many people in terms of moving towards a state of optimum wellness. And that would be balancing the thyroid and adrenal gland.
Yeah, that is definitely, there's a lot to talk about there, let me tell you. You know, it's interesting because I lecture all over the United States, and I think with my, $120,000 in student loans and many, many, many years of school and two residencies that I'm responsible to know what an adrenal gland is and where it is in the body and what its function is and what it secretes and cortisol and all that stuff. But it's amazing to me how big this is, because these are medical terms that have seeped into the lay population because it's such a prevalent condition in our 21st century.
Well, let's talk about, just very simply to start off with, what are the thyroid and adrenal glands and what do they do?
So overall, if we think about it, they are glands. So they're part of our overall endocrine system. That's our hormone system. And Deepak Chopra, I think, says it best about the endocrine system. You touch one strand and the whole web trembles. This is one of the most sophisticated, interconnected internet systems in our body. And so we can't really isolate. This is kind of like an orchestra, and everybody has to be playing together in tune in order to stay in balance, okay? And so the thyroid, as we know, is a gland, it's a butterfly-shaped gland that sits sort of at the level of the cricoid cartilage, right in our throat there. And at the end of the day with the thyroid gland and the hormones that it produces. Now, there's a lot to talk about with the thyroid, but when active thyroid hormone gets into each and every cell of our bodies, it is responsible for both aerobic and anaerobic metabolism, okay? That's the biggest thing. It goes through a lot, it has to be peripherally converted from inactive thyroid to active thyroid. There's many different things in our modern day that will get in the way. I think the thyroid processes are kind of like a relay race. There's many different places along the track, from the brain where the thyroid activity starts all the way to the cell and the receptor site for that hormone where they can drop the baton for the most part. So, but the thyroid and the thyroid hormones, they are responsible for metabolism. So overall, every single cell in our body, aerobic and anaerobic. The adrenals, those are two little kidney bean-shaped glands that sit on the top poles of the kidney, and they're responsible for our stress. They're our stress glands for the most part. They produce many of our steroid hormones that keep us healthy, both physically and mentally, and they are the one gland that responds to, well, in our modern day, the chronic stressors and gets the ball rolling for our stress response, which is that very primal fight or flight.
Now, I really loved your description talking about comparing the endocrine glands to teenagers on smartphones constantly texting one another with the latest updates.
Yes. That's exactly what they'll do. These glands are communicating, just incessantly, just like teenagers on smartphones. You're right, texting. Because they're working together. Especially other organs in the endocrine system, the pancreas, et cetera, but the adrenal thyroid have a very, very, very close relationship. And for the most part, we've heard in the, it's kind of, adrenal dysregulation is what I would call it, because I think, but it's in the layperson's term, you hear people all the time saying adrenal fatigue. My adrenals are burnt out. My adrenals are shot. And what that means is that these adrenal glands are responding to so many of our chronic modern-day stressors, okay? This primal mechanism of fight or flight, we just weren't really, it never has evolved with our modern day. So when every so often, like once a week or so, a polar bear would come out or the locusts were coming and you had to protect the crops. So that was a stressor. You would mount a response, and the response was supposed to get you to move, right? To either fight or get the heck out of there, fly. Well, in our modern day, right, we're sitting behind a computer monitor. We're not moving anywhere. We get an email, and we have that response. We walk into our kid's room. They haven't cleaned it. We get that response. We're sitting in traffic late for an appointment. We get that response. We're sitting behind our checkbook trying to balance it. We get that response. You name it, and that stressor response is going off. And so what happens is that gland starts to fatigue. And your body is meant to take care of you. And there are going to be compensatory mechanisms along the way trying to compensate for that chronic fatigue.
that's a very good description of how life today is different than perhaps when these mechanisms evolved. Let's talk about some of the symptoms, because this is where it becomes very personal to people. They may be listening to us today. Can I call you Dr. Holly? You have kind of like two first names.
Oh, sure. Right? Dr. Holly is perfect.
And, you know, they may go, okay, well, that sounds a little complicated. They signal each other and they change metabolic processes. But what does that mean for me? What are some of the symptoms that people might find themselves with if either or both of these glands are not working optimally?
Sure. So one of the biggest things, and once again, the body is a great communicator, so many symptoms might start to rear their heads, but one of the biggest things for either one of these dysfunctions would be fatigue. And I'm talking about fatigue where you feel like you've gotten bit by a tsetse fly fatigue, and also perhaps you caught up in your sleep, but guess what? You don't wake rested. And then there's a little dip at about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon where you feel like you have to reach for a Diet Coke or another cup of coffee, and you feel like you're trying to medicate your energy throughout the day. Fatigue is definitely one of them. When we look at underfunctioning thyroid, simply you could see an underfunctioning in any part of your metabolism, digestion that can get sluggish. Also, with adrenal dysregulation and fatigue, digestion in constipation, gas, bloating, that starts to be an issue. Your hair might start to thin. Your nails might become cracked and brittle. Constipation, once again, with hypothyroidism. Sleeplessness, the inability to lose weight, or really stubborn weight gain for the most part. Sometimes you'll see, if you look in the mirror, there'll be kind of like a scallop tongue. And so your tongue is wet and flabby, kind of puffy it almost looks like. I always look at people's tongues. I think they tell me so much. Something you can take for thyroid, a basal body temperature. So understand if your metabolism is just, if you are running really, really low.
Well, that is a great list of possible symptoms that people can watch for. And we're going to just go for a little break so that Progressive Radio Network can let people know about some of the other wonderful shows that we have right here. And when we come back, we will continue our discussion with Dr. Holly Lucille. So we'll be right back with more on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Welcome back once more right here to Progressive Radio Network, and you are listening to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. You can always find out more at naturalnurse.com or friend us on Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And today our guest is Holly Lucille, that's Dr. Holly Lucille, who is a naturopathic physician as well as an RN. And she is nationally recognized and licensed naturopathic doctor, an educator, and natural products consultant. And she is the author of Creating and Maintaining Balance, A Woman's Guide to Safe Natural Hormone Health, and serves on the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians Board of Directors. You can find out more at drhollylucille.com. That's D-R, Holly, H-O-L-L-Y, Lucille, L-U-C-I-L-L-E.com. Or look at the archived show when we're done, and we'll have a way for you to click right on Dr. Holly's website. You've been telling us, Dr. Holly, welcome back to the show. We've been talking about thyroid and adrenal health, which is just one of the many things that you discuss in a lot of articles that you've written. You seem to do weekly video blogging, and you have so much information on your website. Let's talk a little bit about the testing, because I'm sure the testing that you and other naturopathic physicians do is so very different from the conventional model of adrenal and thyroid testing.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, I think I've always said, and I will say it again, that it's so important to treat people and not lab tests. If you go back into sort of medicine in general, lab tests are always run in the most prudent way to confirm clinical suspicions. That means you partner with the patient, you understand what their clinical picture is, what their history is, you do good clinical acumen, you kind of formulate like, yeah, I think this might be what's going on. Let's confirm it. Instead of using these lab tests as the directors. You know what I'm saying? And so, there's a problem. For hypothyroidism, for the most part, first of all, the lab testing is extremely controversial right now, and there's many confusing things being written in the medical literature. But it is not a laboratory phenomenon, and I think that people get missed when we assume that it is, because I have too many people coming into my practice, lab tests in hand, everything's within normal limits, and I don't think there's a more frustrating situation for when somebody is not feeling okay, like they're not feeling well, and they're not feeling fine, but their lab tests, they're told, are fine. And so the problem with lab tests for thyroid is that if you even go into the endocrine journals, they have been outdated for decades, absolute decades. And the TSH is the gold standard right now, and it really is not a very effective test to understand thyroid function. It's a wonderful test perhaps to detect a pituitary tumor, but it really falls short, in my opinion, of being able to understand complete thyroid function. There's many, 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 many other things. I personally, for thyroid, I pull in the basal body temperature. That is definitely something that I do. I like it because also you start to see somebody's temperature come up when they start to heal.
Let's discuss that, because basal body temperature goes back on your discussion of self-care, because that's not something you can just go get done at your doctor's office.
Right. This is something that you actually get some instructions, and you know, I always try to get people to source their own information as much as possible, or give them a tool. But for the most part, the thing to do is take that thermometer, and I still like the mercury thermometers. You can still get them, set it by the bedside. When you wake up 3 mornings in a row, the first thing you do, don't even open your eyes. That goes right under the axillary part of your arm, so right under your arm. And you just lie there for 10 minutes and record your temperature. And once again, there's different things that we go on in our lives that might affect that temperature, but we start to see a pattern and a trend, and it's helpful. There's also the Achilles reflex return. I'll use that. But I do use more conventional labs, but I like to expand it. So I like to get a TSH. I also like to get a free T3 and a free T4 and a total T4, because with those numbers, I can start making some assumptions if I see a decrease in conversion, if I see that there might be excessive binding. And then I also like to get a ferritin level, because ferritin is iron storage, and that's been shown to facilitate thyroid hormone into the cell, all right? And then also vitamin D, because vitamin D in optimal levels, not just one click above rickets in the 60s to 80s, is also really important for usage of the thyroid hormone. And so I'll just look at it much, much more comprehensively.
Now, that's excellent, because then you're getting a bigger picture along with your clinical assessment of what might be going on with someone. Now, if you have determined that perhaps we have a sluggish thyroid, or there's an interference with the adrenal thyroid access, what are some of the natural therapies as a naturopathic physician that you might institute?
One of the things that is sort of a go-to for me in this day and age for folks I truly don't think that it's that one person walks out of my office without a blend of adaptogens. And adaptogens are really they're my favorite botanicals at this time. And what adaptogens are, and Terry Naturally, they have a wonderful Terry Naturally by Europharma. They have a wonderful blend of adaptogens called Adaptra, so A-D-A-P-T-R-A. And they're a blend of things like Eleutherococcus or Siberian ginseng, ashwagandha, rhodiola. I call them fuse lengtheners because, in my opinion, when I hear my patients' stories, it's going to be some time before they can really start to mitigate some of their chronic stressors. And in order to help their lifestyle and assist their protect their body from the amount of stressors that they're responding to, adaptogens are wonderful to do that. And so that's very, very important. With thyroid, the same thing. You know what? Big thing about thyroid is you need thyroid, the building blocks to make thyroid hormone. And a lot of people are deficient in, well, especially one of the building blocks, that's iodine. The T stands for tyrosine, so you get T3 or T4, we hear that. So it's either T, so tyrosine, which is either three iodine molecules, or tyrosine with four iodine molecules. That's what that is. But a lot of people are deficient in iodine. So if you don't have the building blocks, you kind of can't even get started out of the block. You know, if you're talking about this relay race, we're not even being able to make those thyroid hormones. And so iodine supplementation is oftentimes necessary. Another controversial, kind of subject in the natural health world, but I have no problem. We can do an iodine spot test, but that, you know,
well,
we
let's
don't
talk about that. You know, you and I know what that is, but why don't we explain to the listeners what an iodine spot test is? Because it's a really
easy
thing.
This is, I think, one of the most effective ways to perhaps understand iron levels in a person's body, because we don't sequester iodine like we do other minerals. And so we need to get it in daily, mostly through nutrition, and a lot of people aren't. And so it's a urine spot test, so very easy, non-invasive, inexpensive test to just understand iodine levels in the body.
And that's useful, so you would have people do that.
Yeah, but have people do that. And then there's many different dosages. Once again, there's something called tri-iodine, and there's many different forms of iodine. And a lot of times we don't need to put people on high doses for a long period of time. If there's a deficiency, we can get it on board, and then we can pull back down. I think each individual case needs to be taken into consideration with some of the thought processes out there, because there's many schools of thought from different talking heads in the medical community. But with each individual case, if you take it up and you understand, you can really supplement very, very safely with iodine and get that building block back on board.
Well, talk about the various kinds of iodine, because I know so many people who are considered low in iron, for instance, are given a conventional kind of therapeutic called ferrous sulfate, which is not the best choice in terms of form. There are others that are taken up better, that don't release so many negative free radicals. And the same is true with various forms of iodine.
Right, right. So ferrous sulfate, you're talking about like with an iron supplementation, right?
Yeah,
so, yeah,
exactly.
With iron, I like the bisglycinate form because it's gentle. It doesn't cause those GI symptoms. But same thing with there are different, and they're basically molecules that are together, like there's a molecular iodine from kelp. A potassium iodide is another one. Sodium iodide. So these are salts that are kind of combined together. Quite honestly, I think a blend, and I always think this through when we're talking about natural supplementation, because depending on the person's pH, depending on their individual biochemistry, I think a blend of the different types of nutritional iodine together can potentially ensure better absorption and then also effectiveness with each and every individual. And the tri-iodine, you make that happen.
Right. Now, let's see. Is there some kind of iodide that people have heard a lot about because of the radiation scare with Fukushima?
Well, mostly potassium iodine. That's what they've heard about because the thing is, if we don't have iodine available to us in our bodies, we're going to be able to then absorb it from the environment. And that's where radiation, chloride, bromide, fluorides, that's just a dangerous place to be in. So the potassium iodide is what I think people were encouraged to go out and get very high dosages of. So, yes, that's important. And nutritionally, if you look at sort of the literature around the world, if we eat good sea vegetables and seafood and keep a daily dose of iodine on board, 1 to 2 milligrams, but oftentimes people are so deficient that integrative practitioners are suggesting up to 50 milligrams a day for 3 months. And then, like I said, you drop that down to either 6.5 or maybe 12.5 milligrams and see how they do. Very, very important.
So you would assess the levels again after someone takes it for a certain amount of time.
And sometimes I don't do a retest. You know what I do is I pay attention to their symptoms. And if there are symptoms of hypothyroidism are starting to abate, then I feel like we've done our job. Because the thing with thyroid is you want to be able to restore the normal thyroid, restore the normal function of the thyroid first, instead of just replacing it with a medication, because that is a lifelong sentence and usually very dangerous when there could have been so many just little tweaks that we could have done before we got there.
So by that, you mean something like just starting on Synthroid, for instance?
That's correct.
And sometimes I'm sure that is the answer for some individuals if there's no other way. For instance, what if they had their thyroid irradiated and it's just not there anymore?
Right. So if there had been an autoimmune disease or if their thyroid is irradiated, then that is certainly a case where replacement is definitely going to be important.
And do you have any opinion about the use of Omothyroid versus Synthroid?
So a lot of times, you know, one of the things with Synthroid is it's straight T4, okay? So mostly an inactive, it's a pro-hormone, it's not even a hormone. And we have to depend on our body to peripherally, in the peripheral tissues, mostly in the liver, convert it into. And there are many different things, nutritional deficiencies, heavy metal influences that will stop that conversion. Too much cortisol, so the adrenal, too little cortisol as well, that will stop that conversion. So if you are just giving T4, we've got to make sure that everything else is in, you know, up to snuff so they're converting into active T3. Armor and any other, you know, as far as I'm concerned, there's only one source. There's only one source of porcine thyroid, okay? You can call it, there's different brands, but there's only one source. And people do fine with that for the most part. If people come in my office and they're on Synthroid because of an autoimmune condition or because they've had radiation or what have you, I don't take, and they're doing fine and I think they're converting, I don't switch them. There's no need.
Well, right. They're doing well. Like you said, you always focus on the clinical picture. Now, you've been talking about the interplay between the thyroid and the adrenal gland. And so if someone were to start out or embark on a optimization program for getting both of those glands to work well, would you say they should work on one and then the other, or really focus on both of them simultaneously?
Well, nutritionally, you can support both, but you're not ever going to be able to heal the thyroid unless you heal the adrenals first. And so mitigating stressors, increasing your fuse so you can respond to stressors better and it's not so damaging for your body, where you can have a better, you know, where you can have an increase in stress, in the ability to handle stress, I should say.
Yeah, that's such a good delineation, you know, Dr. Holly, because everyone has stress, but where the body comes in terms of its ability to handle it is really individual, because that same exact stressful event can register very differently according to people's innate stress mechanisms and also learned stress mechanisms, which are actually a very good thing to do, such as deep breathing.
Right. Well, and that's the thing. It's like, I think when people get overwhelmed and they have adrenal dysregulation and adrenal fatigue, they have an increase in stress resistance, or a decrease, excuse me, in stress resistance, meaning everything is a big deal. And then it's a slippery slope and everything turns into a vicious cycle and makes things worse. And so if we can get people on adaptogens and if we can get people just being aware that this is an area of their lives where they need to concentrate on, there's got to be some. What I have people do is try to balance it out with some parasympathetic activity, meaning opposite of sympathetic activity, where you're with the fight or flight. So where is it that you unburden? Not a lot of time. Not I wouldn't say quantity is going to be there, but the quality of, if you can have, like for me, being around my cats even, or being outside with wildlife, or being outside, period. For me, if I just need a break, I'll take a walk. Like, I condition myself. There's alternative nostril breathing that people can do. Some people like taking a bath. What is it every day where you can just know that you can unburden and that don't sweat the small stuff and that everything is small stuff, you know, for the most part?
Right, and that actually has to be built into your routine so that you don't forget to do it. And
yeah, it's
got to
be a
major difference.
Right, huge, and you got to be able to break that cycle.
Now, I know that you are also politically active because it's no small task to be on the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians Board of Directors. And I believe you live on the West Coast, but are you aware that there are votes coming up for allowing that license to be a recognized physician in New York?
Oh, absolutely. We've been tweeting and Facebooking and cap-whizzing and trying to get everybody that I know in the state of New York to make those calls. It's the eighth time that we've gone. We're very, very close, and it's very, very, very important that I can't stress enough the importance of New York being able to be recognized as licensing naturopathic doctors.
Well, tell us more of what somebody can actually do to take action on that front.
You bet. Okay, so I'm looking this up directly right now.
I think it's such an important thing because people want access to the kind of knowledge that you have and that trained and licensed naturopathic physicians have. And the other problem is in New York, without a licensing law, pretty much anyone can call themselves a naturopathic physician, whether they're highly trained like yourself or not.
That is the thing that it's something to protect the public, absolutely. I think that's extremely important. It's also to have access, like you said, so people can just know about us and have access, and then it's definitely something to do. And I am looking for the direct number, and I apologize.
Okay, well, is there a good website that people can visit to find out more about naturopathic physicians and what's going on in New York?
Yes, hang on here. I'm clicking on it right now. Mm-mm. Well, if you go to, I'm going to send you to the, if you go to naturedoctor.org and you spell that out.
So what was that again?
Naturedoctor.org.
Okay, that's a good one.
And actually, that is the American Association, and they will have definitely updates on what we can do to support New York at this time. And I'm sorry that I can't be a little bit more succinct in getting you information.
No, that's fine.
On
at least people are knowing this is an issue that's actually pretty current and is coming up really soon. And
yeah, I appreciate
that if we take action, I think almost every one of the last few years, it's gotten to somewhere on up to a vote almost. And then, of course, the forces that be who prefer naturopathic physicians not to be available to constituents get it sort of sidelined for another year.
Yeah, and that's the problem with legislative process. If we don't get it through, it's you're right, it takes, you know, another entire year. And so it would be just amazing. And here, I think I have a number for you.
Okay.
Here, I have it for you. I think what's really important is...
Yeah, do you have it available?
Call, yes, Assemblywoman Deborah Glick. And
okay.
The number is 518-455-4841. And share your support for licensing naturopathic doctors in New York. And the bill is A3057B.
Well, thank you so much. And I want to thank you so much, Dr. Holly Lucille, for being our guest today with all your wonderful information and really heartfelt advice. And if people want to find out more, they can visit you at drhollylucille.com. That's doctor with a D-R. Or come on board at Progressive Radio Network anytime because you can hear Natural Nurse on the archives, all the old shows we've done, the previously aired shows, a lot of them are not old, but previously aired shows, as well as those of many of the wonderful guests who have shows, including Gary Null, on Gary Null's network, Progressive Radio Network. This is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse. Until next time, check us out at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. Until then, stay healthy.